Hello, everyone. I am Dr. Neil Coker, and on behalf of CME Outfitters, I would like to welcome you to today's educational activity titled Insights into the Impact, Therapeutic Strategies, and Emerging Options in Uncomplicated Urinary Tract Infections. Today's program is supported by an educational grant from GSK, GlaxoSmithKline. And again, my name is Dr. Coker. I am a practicing urologist in Poughkeepsie, New York. I specialize in female pelvic medicine and reconstructive surgery, urogynecology, and pelvic surgery here at Premier Medical Group. And I am delighted to be joined today by my distinguished panel and ask that they introduce themselves, starting with Dr. Catriona Anderson.
Hello there, and thank you so much for the welcome. My name is Dr. Kat Anderson. I am a primary care physician, a family doctor, but with a specialist interest in women's health, menopause, and particularly recurrent and persistently recurrent urinary tract infection.
Very good. And now I'd like to introduce Ms. Paula Cobb, our patient advocate.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Paula, and I am a physical therapist by trade. However, I have been unable to work due to chronic urinary tract infections for about 4 years, and so I am now becoming a patient advocate for the thousands of women who suffer from this disease and desperately need help.
Very good. Thank you both for joining me. I think tonight's going to be a great discussion. A few housekeeping points, learning objectives of today's discussion. First learning objective is to identify the impact of uncomplicated as well as complicated urinary tract infections on patients and the healthcare system, considering its burden, quality of life, risk factors, and implications of treatment failure. The second learning objective is to differentiate exactly the types of UTIs, including uncomplicated through its definitions, classifications, and the current evidence-based guidelines for diagnosis and management. We're also going to evaluate the current and emerging therapies for the therapeutic management of uncomplicated UTIs while considering healthcare disparities. So I think it's important that when we start, we have to define exactly what an uncomplicated UTI is. And basically, if you think of a patient you see in the office, it's a patient with really no relevant functional or anatomic abnormalities in the urinary tract, or kidney function or concomitant diseases promoting said UTI or risk of developing serious complications. I would say for my practice as a urologist, most patients are essentially a complicated UTI, but uncomplicated UTIs are extremely common. And the other definitions include acute uncomplicated cystitis of the lower urinary tract versus of the upper urinary tract, such as pyelonephritis. An important distinction is whether there is bacteria identified in an asymptomatic patient known as asymptomatic bacteria, which, again, we define as greater than 10 to the fifth colony forming units without any symptoms whatsoever. And importantly, for those who come back with, say, recurrent symptoms, we define recurrent urinary tract infections as those who have had two symptomatic urinary tract culture-proven urinary tract infections in 6 months or three or more within 12 months. The statistics are extremely important to understand when dealing with this disease burden. UTIs affect 150 million people every year, all over the world. 50% of the adult female population will end up having a urinary tract infection during their lifetime. And it is the most common bacterial infection that's dealt with in the clinical setting. Over 50%, one half of older women experience recurrence within a single year. And over one third of young women will experience a recurrence within 1 year. So this is an extremely common issue that we deal with on a day-to-day basis. When talking to patients, obtaining a history, doing a physical exam, exactly what risk factors should one look for? Well, there's a couple to be keep in mind. Of course, female gender and premenopausal, especially sexually active women. There is a family history that we know about, certain genetic predispositions that one should be aware of. And when it comes to, say, quote, behavioral, unquote, predispositions, as you can see here, there's a number of considerations one has to take into consideration when taking a history. That being said, some of these, at least historically, are more, say, associated with, say, the pediatric population, such as wiping patterns. And actually, Paula, I'd like to ask your opinion on this regarding your experience in dealing with like healthcare professionals when talking about UTIs.
Yeah, so I think one thing that's very important in when we go to a doctor, you know, we don't want to be blamed. So just, you know, saying things like you're not wiping correctly, that's right. Obviously not the case. So, I mean, you use things, it seems like this chronic urinary tract infection, we may not be able to pinpoint it to an actual anything that we have done. It just may be something that has happened. We may have an underlying condition that hasn't been determined yet as to why we're unable to break down bacterial biofilm and such. But I think just listening to your patient, not blaming us for doing something or not doing something that the literature may say we should be doing is very, very important. And then, of course, you know, using good terminology is very important.
Absolutely. I think, you know, language is key when it comes to addressing a patient who presents with symptoms consistent with the urinary tract infection. I'm going to pass this off to you, Dr. Anderson. I know you are a world thought leader when it comes to urinary tract infections. You have grandiose experience when it comes to managing this. How do you go through a patient who comes to you and you think they might have a UTI? How do you start?
Well, of course, to begin with, you have to take a very thorough history. You really need to find out whether, if they're an adult patient, whether it began in childhood. You need to look at their UTI career, because if they are actually somebody who's getting recurrent UTIs, they may well have started with their first UTI and then they didn't suffer very frequently and things have become more frequent over time. And we can look at risk factors. We can take a very, very comprehensive history. And then, of course, this should be followed by examination, particularly important to define whether there is upper urinary tract involvement, that is kidney involvement. And this, of course, can be typically when the patient has tenderness on the examination of the kidneys. Now, we can move on then to using a urinary dipstick, and the dipstick can show leukocyte and nitrite count. And if the leukocyte count and the nitrites are showing positive, it's quite often possible that it's an E. coli infection, and we do know that E. coli is 90% of UTIs. However, we've got to be careful that when a urinary dipstick is negative, that we do not dismiss the patient of not having a UTI. I mean, certainly the UK guidelines where I work have recently been revised to say that, you know, we really should not be relying on these. We must look at symptoms to be making our judgment, our diagnosis. Now, obviously, doctors can judge whether further investigations are needed at this point and send for an ultrasound of the kidneys, the ureters, and the bladder. And this is important to rule out structural abnormalities, although we do find that in the vast majority of cases, there are no structural abnormalities in primary care. And of course, those that we find structural abnormalities, we will be referring on to expert surgeons such as yourself. And so,
great.
The symptoms of UTIs, this is bread and butter. You know, that's a UK phrase for every day for us as primary care physicians, as family doctors. And we know that we can have a myriad of different symptoms. We've got to be very, very aware that if a patient comes in with a fever, so that would be 100.5 Fahrenheit on taking their temperature. We've got to be very, very careful with this patient because obviously we have a higher risk of it involving the kidneys. We have a higher risk of it evolving into urosepsis. And it's really pertinent to start treatment very, very quickly with these patients. Typically, they will be presenting with symptoms of urgency, frequency, painful urination, dysuria. They may have lower abdominal, suprapubic tenderness. They may have this costo-vertebral pain. We don't tend to say it like that in the UK, but I understand that's your terminology. So the pain that they're getting between the pelvis and the lower ribs, especially around the back and on palpation and blotting the kidneys. And if your patient tries to jump off couch when you do that, you can be as sure as anything that it's probably a pyelonephritis. And early treatment is really important. And then we have to be very much aware, especially with our elderly patients, that a new onset of mental status changes, confusion, maybe aggression, can indicate that there is an infection which is affecting them systemically. We may see a leukocytosis of 10 to the 4 cells per cubic millimeter, and if things are actually getting to the point of systemic inflammatory response syndrome, we might actually see the patient dropping their blood pressure with a hypotension of less than 90 mmHg systolic, or two of the SIRS, the systemic inflammatory response syndrome criteria. The other thing that we need to be asking about is, are you passing blood with the urine, or are we seeing microscopic hematuria on dipstick? Now, if none of these symptoms are present, it's probably a good idea to be talking to the patient or trying to work out, especially with women, whether there's something else that could be causing this problem. I say with women because obviously vaginal infections and vulval infections can produce some of the symptoms that we've already mentioned. And we need to consider these alternative causes and obviously maybe not send urine for urine analysis and culture if it's obvious that something else is to blame. So we talked about urine
Dr.
dipsticks.
Before you continue, no, be sorry. Relevant question from the audience. Is it possible for, say, a patient with an uncomplicated lower urinary tract infection to present with CVA, costovertebral angle tenderness, or flank pain? Is that, in your case, a typical or atypical presentation?
Okay, so it's I wouldn't say it's completely atypical, but it's not. I'd say you get maybe one with the indication that there's a pyelonephritis for every 10 other lower UTIs. It's not rare, but it's uncommon. But it's so important. It's the thing you've always got to be aware of. And really, having the patient relaxed, lying on their back, and blotting those kidneys is a very good way. A little squeeze on the kidney is a very, very good way to find out. Another thing that I find quite useful is if you sit the patient on the edge of the couch and you actually percuss using just gently with your fist, and you run it down from their back, you know, sort of like, and you'll hear it sort of making a hollow noise as you're over their rib cage, and then as you get down above the kidneys, the shockwave that goes through will make them start, and they'll say, oh yes, that's tender. So that's another quite good one, but we do have to be careful here with confusing, we call it in the UK lumbago, so lumbar muscle spasm and lumbar muscle tenderness with back pain. And that's quite a common confusion between pyelonephritis. But those patients, they'll be in pain, but they won't be unwell. And with pyelonephritis, patients are usually unwell, and we usually get, some sort of indication with that.
Very good. Very good question from the audience. We're going to keep it flowing. Any questions we don't get, we'll try to get at the end. Thank you, Dr. Anderson.
No worries. So I named this that slide, are you positive, it's negative, because here in the UK, we do find too many healthcare practitioners will have a very symptomatic patient coming in, and then they will say, oh, right, it did sound like you might have a UTI, but the dipstick says no, so off you go, nothing going on. And we do know that up to 50% of dipsticks are negative, yet bacteria will grow and culture. So do not rely on these dipstick tests alone. It has to be taken together with examination and patient symptomatology. And certainly here in the UK, and we'll be talking more about the American guidelines later, we have two symptoms. You know, let's say it was dysuria and frequency, and we should, you know, be using these pivotal symptoms to be predicting uncomplicated urinary tract infection. So ideally, we confirm diagnosis via a urine culture is still regarded as gold standard, and we must always be careful to send for culture in certain groups, and those groups include men, pregnant women, patients with catheters and patients over 65 years of age. But bear in mind that in adult women with painful urination, dysuria, and urinary frequency symptoms, there is more than a 90% probability that it is bacteria infection underpinning those symptoms. And empirical antibiotics can be considered, and you know, depending on the severity of the symptoms and the risk of developing complications and previous antibiotic use, all these things have to be taken into consideration when we decide on which antibiotic to use. So what do we do in this traditional testing that we say is the gold standard? Well, it's all based on the CAS criterion, and that was a study carried out in the USA in 1957 on 88 pregnant women with kidney infections with pyelonephritis. And really, CAS wanted to know, he knew that kidney infections were a great risk to a pregnancy, to the woman losing that pregnancy. And so he said, well, at what level is the danger level? And so he looked at these 88 women and he drew a line in the sand at 10 to the 5. I think you say 10 to the 5th in the USA. So that's 100,000 bacteria per milliliters of urine was said to be a significant infection. But we've got to ask ourselves these days, is this appropriate? And that there is a lot of chat amongst us that are in this area, whether this is appropriate, because we do know that people with recurrent UTI and chronic UTI have these oversensitized bladders, which will react and produce symptoms at much lower levels of bacteria than this. In this traditional testing that we use right across the Western world, we know that anything less than 10 to the 5 is reported as insignificant growth. We know that two or more species of bacteria is reported as mixed growth. And this is a bit of a hark back to Koch's postulates and the single germ theory of disease. And we do know that these patients with more complicated infections in terms of they have persistent recurrence, they quite often have more than two organisms. So we've got to ask ourselves, are we being appropriate with these patients? And we know that 20 to 40% of acute symptomatic patients, so not the recurrent UTIs, will also have counts of less than 100,000 bacteria per milliliter of urine. Yet these patients usually do respond to antibiotics. So what can be done better if we are not using traditional culturing methods, especially for these patients with the recurrent and the chronic UTIs? Well, there are different methods. There are molecular analysis techniques, and you're very lucky out in the USA that you have more labs running these sort of tests. There is more access, I believe, certainly in the private sector to these tests. We do use it occasionally in the UK, but not nearly as much. But we do have, mainly in the private sector in the UK, not so much in the government sector, is the liquid and enrichment medium culture. And this is known as the enhanced quantitative urine culture. And we find that the selected nutrients in the liquid culture is actually more appropriate and replicates better the liquid environment in the bladder. And this fluid medium also allows viable but dormant, non-dividing bacteria to be kicked back into their exponential growth phase, kicked back into the planktonic stage where they're reproducing every 20 to 30 minutes rather than, as we'll discuss later, being site-specified, being hunkered down in their little homes and actually turning off their rapid reproduction genes, turning off their replication every 20 minutes and actually only reproducing much more slowly and being really in quite a quiescent state. Now, these sort of liquid broth cultures are actually that they're very, very sensitive, very, very detailed, and they will go down way below the 10 to the 5, and they will find normal flora, normal healthy bacteria that are meant to be in the urine. But actually, that can be reported by the microbiologist and by the physician who's interpreting the results. It's not difficult to do, and that can be taken into account.
Those are great points. A few questions from the audience. Thanks for an active participation, everyone listening. So you know, one question was, if the dipstick is so unreliable, what really is the purpose of running this test? And I think I can comment saying that when you have a positive, the positive predictive value is fairly indicative that there's a UTI, you know, correlating with the clinical history and your exam. So when it's lighting up, you can tell that it supports your diagnosis. Another comment mentioned that from, say, January of this year through, you know, Q1, March of this year, they had 1,000 E. coli. They grew cultures and half were nitrite negative and half were positive. So again, further emphasizing that you really need to take a solid history, take a look at the patient, get the story, and then correlate it with your findings, because these bacteria clearly aren't playing by the rules every time. Speaking to that, you know, when we talk about definitions, all right, we say that, you know, for example, recurrent UTIs, 2 in 6 months, 3 or more in a year defines recurrent. These things are not exactly black and white, okay, even definitions. It's semi-objective how we define a positive culture, 10 to the fifth as an American versus 10 to the five. But ultimately, this is a continuum, and it is a bit gray area, less black and white in clinical practice. So you have to be mindful, you have to ask good questions, listen to the patient, and really figure out where they are perhaps on this trajectory versus, you know, an acute to these frequent, recurrent, or constant issues. So please bear that in mind as you're evaluating this patient. What defines failure? Exactly who or what patients are going to fail treatment? And it's sort of the typical players, say elderly, pregnant, diabetes, immunosuppressed, renal impairment, whatever antibiotic was chosen, maybe, you know, the duration was not enough for that particular patient. Increasing antibiotic resistance is huge globally, locally, antibiograms in each area. And, you know, certainly the United Kingdom have excellent data looking at, you know, using the same antibiotic. It happens often in 25% to continue to treat. Maybe that's not the right choice. Maybe it is. But there's a lot of nuance. I think that's the important point here when it comes to treating patients with UTIs. So who are we missing exactly? Like what should you look out for? How do we prevent those patients from falling through the cracks? There's a lot of lost follow-up. We're going to talk later about these social determinants of care that play a huge role, health literacy, access to care, patient and clinician rapport, clinician understanding of the situation, perhaps misdiagnosis. I mean, you can imagine on a differential, there's tons of things that overlap. And so I really think it's important to listen to the patient, meet their needs, and have a thorough, comprehensive discussion. Paula, can you comment exactly from the patient's side how this affects you and the quality of life that it takes from day to day?
So I moderate 2 Facebook pages, so I am in constant contact with women just on a daily basis. And I myself have been dealing with this since 1994, before all the PCR tests and all of this stuff ever existed. So, and I want to say as far as, you know, communication where he just left off, and on going through all the tests and all the analysis of the dipstick and the blood work and all of that, the cultures, if a patient is symptomatic, I think that is the most important thing that you need to listen to. If you have a patient that says they feel sick, you know, we really need to be listened. And, you know, there is no part of our lives that is not affected by this disease. I told you in my introduction, I've been 4 years now without work because I'm unable to due to symptoms of chronic urinary tract infection. The impact of this illness plays on a particular part of our lives, of course, will be dictated on certain things like age. If you're younger, you're going to be more sexually active, and that may be a relationship, a partner issue. And also, the impact will also deal with how much support we have from friends and family and how much understanding we have. But I've put some really important things down here on the next couple of slides. Number one, I want to say we develop in this community a really big fear of doctors, anxiety when we go to a doctor because we're not afraid. We're afraid we're not going to be listened to or understood or dismissed. That happens a lot with our clientele. So we get a lot of anxiety when we go to doctors, and I'm sure some of you guys have seen that. there's a lot of expense because medical insurance doesn't cover a lot of our needs. We have to go to naturopaths, and none of that is covered by our insurance. So it's mostly an out-of-pocket thing for medical care, doctor's visits, and any sort of supplementation that we need to take to boost our systems. Usually the antibiotics are covered in most cases, but unfortunately, and then some of the testing may not be covered as well. So it's a huge financial burden on us as a patient. Lack of intimacy with partner, I also told you that. I have talked to women who are unable to be intimate and their partner's not understanding, so their relationship gets tossed out the window. Decreased social interaction is very huge in our group. We don't go out because we don't feel good. We don't go out because we can't drink and partake of beverages and have a good time. We don't go out because we can't eat certain foods that we need to, and we just can't enjoy ourselves. And for some reason, can somebody advance that for me, please? Thank you.
No.
Decreased work. I'm out of work. A lot of women can't work. That's very, very common in our group. Poor mental health. Like I said, we have anxiety and depression. We have anxiety and depression because we go to the doctors and we're not listened to. We have anxiety and depression because we don't have friends and relationships anymore. It's a huge impact in us. In the two groups that I moderate, last year we had four young mothers commit suicide, four, all because they had no hope. And that's huge in our community. We should not have young women killing themselves because they're in such pain and they don't feel like that they have any hope of ever getting any better. Inability to travel, like I said, social events, there's nothing that this disease doesn't touch. And of course, my last point, you know, we don't sleep well. So it's just a huge, overwhelming cluster of symptoms, mental symptoms, physical symptoms that just controls our lives, basically.
So. Paul, I want to thank you for being here and sharing your experience. And I think you hit on a lot of major points regarding how we approach a patient every single day and to be mindful of that and those challenges. So thank you. Dr. Anderson, I know you're very passionate about this topic. Can you teach us exactly what a biofilm is? There have been a few questions in the chat. And so how do I tell a patient what a biofilm is? Where do I start?
Biofilms were discovered by Bill Costerton back in the 1980s. Actually, I'm going to give a little anecdote. So he was a microbiologist, and he was walking in the Bugaboo Range of the Rockies. And like any good microbiologist, he had a sterile sample pot in his backpack. And he was just walking over a stream when he slipped on a rock and fell on his backside. And he thought, my gosh, that rock's slippy. Why is that rock slippy? You know, what is it that's making that rock slippy? The water was as clear as crystal. And he picked up a slimy stone and he popped it in a little sandwich bag. And he also took a sample of the water and he took them back to his lab. And he had a little look and he found that the water was so clear that there were only 6 to 8 bacteria per mil, which is good enough for drinking water, to be honest. But the rock was covered in this slimy layer that inside, when he got it under the microscope and under the electron microscope, he could see that there was this whole like community of bacteria. And he termed this thing biofilm. And he really was the father of biofilms. And it came from Montana University, and they have become a very famous university working on biofilm engineering and biofilm science. And they're very involved with the oil industry because it's biofilms that clog oil pipes and block them. It's very expensive. To be honest, it's biofilms that are on your teeth. We brush our teeth every morning, but by nighttime, they're getting fuzzy again. And so we brush that biofilm off again. So biofilm is ubiquitous throughout nature. It is a structured community of bacterial cells enclosed in a self-produced polymeric matrix and adherent to an inert or a living surface. So they can, it can be biotic or abiotic. And we know that over 80% of bacteria in the universe exist in biofilm phenotype. And it's particularly common in aqueous environments. If you popped your finger into the drain in your wash basin, you would find that it's slimy. You're feeling biofilm. And biofilms are highly resistant to being destroyed. In fact, if you took a glass slide covered in biofilm and you dropped it into, we call it bleach. Do you call it bleach? You know, the stuff you put down toilets to sterilize them?
It's bleach. Yep.
Yeah, right. Okay. You would find that at 24 hours, you still had some surviving bacteria deep inside the biofilm. So it's a really tricky thing to deal with. And so it's hardly surprised that these patients, if they get biofilm, they really suffer. So here we have a coronal section through a bladder. And you can see this bladder and you can see the little ureteric orifices sat there at either end of the trigone. And we've got a nice little expanded portion showing our cell layer and our urothelium with our nice stretchy facet cells. We call them umbrella cells. Do you do that too?
Yep.
So we've got our transitional epithelium, and here comes along an E. coli, okay, a uropathogenic E. coli, and it lands on the cells. And like we said earlier, in fact, Dr. Coker said earlier that some people have got more permissive epithelial cells than others in terms of bacteria sticking. If you want to put it in layman's term, some people are just more sticky to bugs than others. And we certainly know that the TLR5 SNP mutation that some people have, it's only 10% of the population, but 50 to 60% of recurrent UTI patients have actually got this TLR5 SNP. And so the bugs, they attach on to the surface, and it triggers a receptor, then a second messenger system within the cell, which leads to an entrapping of the bacteria. The cell membrane actually forms a pocket and literally takes it into the cell cytoplasm. The bacteria sitting in there says, great, we've got no nasty acidic urine trying to wash us out and kill us. We've got plenty of food in here. Let's form a colony. So they start reproducing nicely, and then they get to the point where they're absolutely filling the cell. They are site specified. They are space limited. They are now nutrient limited. And so what they do is they communicate amongst themselves. It's called quorum sensing. And they actually talk amongst themselves with chemical messengers saying, we've got to go into a different mode because we're running out of resources. So they go dormant, quiescent. And this is the cells that actually we talked about that aren't so easy to grow on traditional agar cultures and much easier to grow on the liquid cultures. Now, that's the IBC formation that we've seen after the intracellular replication. But then we go on to the fluxing and filamentation, and you look at it and you think to yourself, well, why are there little sausage shapes and why are there long spaghetti shapes? Well, actually, that's your physiological adaptation to an aqueous liquid environment. And I'll just put it to you. If I gave you a wet sausage and a wet piece of spaghetti, and I told you to throw both at a wall, which one would stick? Yep, the spaghetti. And this is exactly what these cells do. They actually adapt themselves into a completely different morphological shape to give themselves more properties of adhesion to the epithelial bladder cell wall to allow them to stick there long enough because they're being washed by urine, and allow them to get their anchors in so that they can set off a new round of infection on new territory. Now, the body knows this is going on. It is acting, against the infection. It is becoming inflamed. If you look very carefully, you can see these little crescent-shaped nuclei, these little polymorphonuclear cells, your neutrophils, your white blood cells coming along, trying to kill off the infection, but unfortunately, because it is an intracellular biofilm-like community, those immune cells have got as much chance of getting inside that cell as getting a Zeppelin airship through a kitchen window. It ain't going to happen. And so what the body does is it says, we can't rid ourselves of this infection within the cell. Let's sacrifice the cell. So it turns on P53, programmed cell death, apoptosis, and you get shedding. And this is actually really pertinent because when you get that patient in your clinic room, the best thing you can do to tell whether you've got a recurrent UTI, apart from history and knowing that they're like a revolving door patient because they keep coming in saying, doctor, it's back again. I'm only a week or two past the antibiotics and I'm symptomatic again. Take their urine sample, give it a shake, hold it up to the window, hold it up to the light. And if it looks like one of those little snowstorms, you know, you get the little kids' snowstorms that you turn upside down and you've got loads of cellular debris flying around, you're probably dealing with somebody who's got this phenomenon and they are going to be trickier to treat. So we've seen it on the cartoon, on the diagrams. This is it happening in real life. On the left, you've got the pink and purple picture looking down the light microscope, the cell that is stuffed full of intracellular biofilm-like community, and the little bacteria all being liberated, fluxing out. And then if we go over to the right, figure two, we've got electron micrographs of varying resolutions showing this cell that's stuffed to you know, and full fit to burst. And then we've got higher resolutions looking at the pores and the cracks on the top of the cell where the bacteria flux out and showing you that there is that bacterial community inside.
Wow.
Right. Dr. Coker, it feels like I should hand over to you now rather than talk about the Texas study myself. It's up to you, though.
No worries. I think you hit all the high points. I mean, those biofilms, I almost want to print that slide and put it on a handout and show patients, like, you see now exactly what we're dealing with and how we have to treat it. I think your point is correct in that these biofilms are, I would say, ubiquitous in nature, and they can affect all different types of tissues. They can affect implants, device-related infections. So we know this is a real entity, and we need to treat it accordingly. When it comes to treatments for, say, a patient with recurrent, the just revolving door, as you mentioned, or a chronic UTI, I can't think of any one single therapy that has come out that we've utilized in a safe manner for the postmenopausal women, especially, as effective as topical vaginal estrogen. Can you?
I agree completely.
Thumbs up. It is a game changer. I mean, I use it and prescribe it in my practice as a urologist, as a surgeon, easily 10 times a day. It is extremely safe. It has been shown in multiple high-quality data studies, even in patients with estrogen receptor positive cancer history, to still be safe. I think you had mentioned the amount, the dose, as we were over this. Can you say that again? Because I don't remember the exact.
Yeah, absolutely. The most potent licensed dose of vaginal estrogen, estradiol, is 10 micrograms. And if you add together the twice a week dosing of 10 micrograms for a year, you don't even make a full tablet of oral HRT, systemic HRT, because we know that, you know, most women, when they're on oral HRT, are on 2,000 micrograms daily.
Wow.
So 1 year worth of the most potent vaginal estrogen doesn't even make 1 day of systemic oral HRT. And this is why it's such a low dose that it's so safe, and yet it's so well absorbed by the proximal vagina and shared out in the pelvis, and the bladder gets a dose, the urethra gets a dose, and it doesn't just increase the robustness of the tissues and increase the innate defense mechanisms, but it also encourages the bladder and the vagina to produce its own antimicrobial peptides, which we know cleave bacteria and help keep the bad bugs at bay and encourage the growth of healthy lactobacillus acidophilus that keep the nice acidic conditions in the vagina and reduce the likelihood of vaginal infections, which can act as a reservoir to seed UTIs.
It's incredible. So in the interest of time, I'm going to keep the slides moving. As mentioned here, there are certain bladder installations. I know we had talked perhaps not as utilized as commonly in either our side of the pond or yours, but certainly something to keep in mind for the, especially refractory cases. There's a lot of new exciting data on these vaccine therapies that are yet not licensed or available. But the point is that you really got to take a good history. You really can use good physical exam. You mentioned the shaking phenomenon of the urine, and that there this is a high speed moving field, and there's a lot of exciting therapies on the horizon.
Can I just interject real quick about the vaginal estrogen is awesome, and I highly promote it.
Thank you.
However, be aware. Women with really sensitive bladders, if there's a filler or an additive in that estrogen or vaginal cream, their bladders are going to react negatively. It happened to me, and I tried it twice, made my bladder worse, so I have to do oral. But just be aware of that.
You may want to
refer them to a compounding pharmacy and find a base. That will work with them.
There are these additives that can be, you know, to improve shelf life or what have you. And so local compounding can essentially make it without those sort of fresh, quote unquote. And that can make all the difference for patients when applying to get them the drug in the safest manner possible. Dr. Anderson, do you want to comment on this slide regarding these?
Yeah, so just very briefly, there was a very elegant study in 2017 in Belgium where they took 220 symptomatic women who had all showed negative on standard cultures despite their symptoms. They took them in a little trial together with 86 healthy students who'd never had a UTI, and they looked at them using the enhanced urine cultures, using liquid media, and also using PCR molecular. And they found that of the symptomatic group, despite them all being negative on the CAS criterion, on the agars, nearly 81% were positive on the cultures, the extended urine cultures using the broth liquid, and nearly 96% on the qPCR. We always expect 10% of the population to have asymptomatic bacteria in the urine, bacteriuria, and that was borne out in the control group. So this really, the authors concluded almost all women with typical urinary symptoms and negative cultures had E. coli infection. Obviously, it can be other infections, but, you know, in this study, they were looking at E. coli. Very interesting data showing us that we are ignoring a large cohort of our patients.
Yeah, that's very compelling data. In terms of, say, further treatments when it comes to those patients, again, recurrent, chronic, there is certainly something to be said. I think Dr. Anderson and I agree in, let's say, extended courses of antibiotics, especially when, say, a biofilm situation is suspected, complicated situations like bacterial endocarditis, bronchiectasis. These patients need longer courses than, let's say, the quote-unquote standard course. And so don't, I guess, be timid or feel as though you're doing a disservice to your patients giving them longer courses, because, frankly, there are many, many patients that would benefit from said extended courses. We'll talk about that a little bit later. The role of prophylactic antibiotics, I use this a lot, especially in conjunction with, say, a non-antibiotic like methenamine. We'll get into that a little bit later. And again, methenamine itself is, at least in the U.S., indicated in the U.K. for prophylactic against UTIs. It's just a great overall therapy. Really quick, extended course antibiotics. Recall that the bladder cells itself do take essentially 3 months, 90 days to turn over. So if we're worried there's a IBC biofilm situation, you really want to cover for, let's say, a 90-day period, and then consider maybe what I think of as a drug holiday to see how they do off of the prophylactic antibiotics, because these bacteria will hide in the cells and cause issues such as recurrent UTIs once they're off a treatment course. And so that longer course allows those cells to turn over in a positive environment to essentially eliminate them entirely. When it comes to the evidence, okay, for say an uncomplicated UTI, healthy host, exactly what is it we should follow? One question in the chat mentioned, how long do you give, for example, nitrofurantoin? I know in our side, we tend to do a 5-day course, recognizing for folks who have less a robust kidney function, you really want to avoid that as it will not work. Trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, this is typically a 3-day course. We are seeing more E. coli resistance in our antibiograms. I think that's a global pattern. And there are many, let's say, older or less utilized but good alternatives, such as fosfomycin, which comes in a granule packet. But this can be expensive. I know, at least in my side of things, I try to get patients on this, and it can be as high as $60 a dose, but and may not be available, frankly, in some retail pharmacies. But it has been shown to be a significant, excellent, a one-time treatment dose, and I like it a lot.
I do.
Yeah. In terms of, let's say, the Infectious Disease Society of America, what do they say? Kind of the same thing. Consider your nitrofurantoin for about a 5-day course, unless you're suspicious of, say, a tissue penetrating, needing an antibiotic like a pyelonephritis. That may not be the proper first-line therapy. Trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, at least 3 days. Again, your mileage may vary for your specific patient, or a fosfomycin course. And then essentially consider, say, bigger gun antibiotics like the fluoroquinolones if required, but not obviously first line anymore. I kind of threw a little allusion to this, but Dr. Anderson, what's your thoughts and experience with methenamine hippurate?
Okay, I love methenamine hippurate. It's absolutely fantastic alternative. And just whisking through this very quickly, because you've got the slides for reference, methenamine hippurate acts actually methenamine and hippuric acid, and in an acidic urine, it will dissociate. And we know that the acid helps the hippuric acid helps maintain an acid environment, allowing the methenamine to produce its antibacterial action. And we know the acid also stops the bacteria from reproducing. And together, they are actually incredibly effective. And the methenamine, when it's hydrolyzed, actually forms formaldehyde in acidic urine, but not in quantities that are damaging to the bladder. It's highly tolerable and highly effective for the majority of patients, and an alternative to prophylactic antibiotics and, of course, antibiotic sparing. So taking that antimicrobial stewardship, is a box that we need to all be ticking worldwide. So it's all based on the OLTAR study, where they took 240 adult women with recurrent UTI requiring prophylactic treatment. It was a direct head-to-head intention to treat study over 12 months, and they received either nitrofurantoin, trimethoprim, or cefalexin daily. And it was quite a unique study in that they were really listening to the patients, and it was self-reported incidence of symptomatic UTI. As well as using cultures and microbiological measures, they were listening to the women, and these women were reliable in knowing when they had UTIs. And it was found at the end of this study that methenamine hippurate was not inferior. It was non-inferior to antibiotic prophylaxis. And the patients were very satisfied with the effectiveness and, low side effect problem. They found it convenient. So all in all, it's really an excellent alternative to using prophylactic antibiotics. And here, just looking at a quick bar chart, and we can see that the incidence rate of UTI in this modified intention to treat population without prophylaxis, large number, but with methenamine and prophylactic antibiotics, that really falls away. I was quite interested in looking at this graph because that doesn't actually mimic real life. I find that in real life that I have greater benefit with this than I do with prophylactic antibiotics once I get patients onto it. So, back over to you, Dr. Cook.
Before we move on to the next slide, I'd like to ask a question from the chat. Is it safe to take, say, methenamine longer than a year? What's your thoughts on that?
Okay. So obviously we have a great need for longer scale studies. But, you know, methanamine's been around for over 100 years. And in 1968, it even went to being over-the-counter medication, certainly here in the UK. It's well known to be incredibly safe. You can use it down to an eGFR of about 10. So, you know, right down into end-stage renal failure. It's incredibly well tolerated. We have had patients taking this, you know, really full dose nonstop for over a decade that we've got, you know, sort of like data on in terms of clinic data, and no problems with liver function, no problems with renal kidney function, etc. It's fine for breastfeeding women, but we don't have it approved for use in pregnancy, although we have one specialist clinic here in London that do actually use it in pregnancy with informed consent, and no deleterious effects have been noticed.
Dr. Anderson, would you recommend a prescription of vitamin C or another supplement to lower the pH?
Okay, funny enough, the evidence doesn't support it, but do you know what? Again, real-world experience in the clinic does support it. And there are various things that can lower pH. And, you know, vitamin C is good. Thank you for that point, Paula. That's a great point. Zinc is quite good, and there's another supplement called methionine that can help drive down the pH, because some people do have an issue with pH, and we do see that it actually works a lot better if we can get the pH below 6. The optimum is to get it below 5.75, and I often encourage these patients who have this recurrent disease to get their own dipsticks and be monitoring their pH so they can keep it. And it seems to be one of those things where if you can get the infection under control with an acute course of antibiotics, the pH of the urine does generally drop. We do see that infections often drive up the pH because of the action of the bacteria on the urine.
Great points. Let's move on to a novel antibiotic. It is pronounced gepotidacin. I practiced for this talk specifically. And this is a really exciting new first in its class antibiotic that inhibits topoisomerase 2 and inhibits bacterial DNA replication. We're going to review a couple of studies that really showed that this is a well-tolerated and effective therapy, more so than nitrofurantoin, and especially for those that are less common, but particularly, let's say, serious infections like Proteus or resistant infections, and those that are intrinsically not susceptible to, let's say, our standard first line like Enterococcus. This is really a player to keep in mind. So what are the data? Essentially, Eagle 2, Eagle 3 study design looked at those with uncomplicated urinary tract infections based on clinical symptoms, as well as dipstick urinalyses as listed on the left. They're randomized 1-to-1, especially with age and recurrence of those uncomplicated UTIs, to either an oral dose of gepotidacin with 1500 BID and a matching nitrofurantoin placebo versus the nitrofurantoin itself. They were treated through essentially 10 to 13 days. Primary efficacy was established with a follow-up at about a month. And what we looked at is that this is a non-inferiority trial that reached significance in that it was as good, if not slightly better, than nitrofurantoin with respect to therapeutic, clinical, microbiologic success in both these two studies. And here are the data. Importantly, if you look and kind of get into the granular of side effects, it's extremely safe. The most common, there were no grade 4 or higher life-threatening or fatal side effects. Most commonly, this resulted in, say, a mild to moderate GI distress or diarrhea. So quite interesting and something to really keep in our back pocket, as this shows strong evidence that gepotidacin is effective and safe oral alternative for the treatment of uncomplicated UTI. It's really good news for those who have resistant bugs, intolerant to other first line, for example, several allergies or what. And the efficacy, again, against these less common but serious uropathogens is something to keep in mind. It's well tolerated, again, with those GI distress symptoms. When it comes to alternative treatments, we talked a little bit about these earlier. I wanted to ask, especially from Paula's side, what have you found to be effective? One of the chat mentioned Eucora. which is there's a lot of ingredients, but mostly D-mannose. What are your thoughts, Paula?
Yeah, so the supplements that we use vary depending on what our symptoms are. A lot of people have more GI distress or vaginal issues than other people, but D-mannose is used a lot. L-orthanine is used a lot. Taurine is used a lot. CoQ10 is used a lot. Allicin, of course, is from garlic. That's a good one. We use Cranstat and we use Trifala a lot as antimicrobials. So, and it just kind of depends on if we have gut issues, we might do some colostrum, L-glutamine, but a lot of us also take magnesium glycinate to help with nerve pain, which is a big part of that. So it just kind of varies.
Yep. So these are definitely something to keep in mind and to talk with your patients and certainly not right off. Dr. Anderson, I know we only have a few minutes. If you'd like to go through the next few slides and kind of lead us into sort of what's next, what are the global impacts of some of these resistance patterns?
Of course. We've really got to think about global impact of antimicrobial resistance because we know we've got big problems. We know that nearly a million estimated deaths each year globally from antimicrobial resistant infections, and that figure is predicted to go up to 10 million by 2050 if we carry on doing nothing. We know that amoxicillin in some countries, we've got up to 100% resistance because it's been overused. And we know that trimethoprim, the resistance rates are up from 29% in 2015 to 34% now. And even nitrofurantoin, which was classically regarded as the antibiotic without much resistance, we're seeing 3% resistance. And so we know that AMR, antimicrobial resistance, is a global problem. It impacts all countries. It's as big a threat as global warming. They reckon that it's going to cost $100 trillion by 2050 if we take no action. And we know that we are generating superbugs, which just do not respond to existing medications. When we see the impact across the globe, we see that in the European Union and the United States, our death rates aren't quite as high as it is in places like Thailand and India, where they are far above us dying of antimicrobial resistant infections. And that must be to do with the fact that there is easier to obtain antibiotics in certain places in the world, over the counter and more readily prescribed. We've all got a role in looking at what we can do. And I'm not saying we not to prescribe antibiotics to your patients, but I'm saying that actually we need to be prudent in our prescribing. We need to, use our diagnostics where we can and use the right antibiotic at the right dose for the right amount of time. This is just mimicking what we've said earlier, looking at the scale of the problem, the projected deaths by 2050 going up to 10 million compared to now if we do nothing. So we know that UTI is a complex problem. We know that one size does not fit all, and we really must stop regarding all UTI as just acute UTI, because I know that certainly happens here in the UK amongst some of my healthcare professional colleagues. It's a myriad of presentations, and people may be more advanced in their UTI career if they have got recurrent UTI going right up to chronic UTI. We have got a lack of good diagnostic options, but more are being developed. So do think along the lines of getting, better bacterial cultures, molecular tests, if you've got it available. So we're looking at personalizing our treatment plan based on good testing, using appropriate antibiotics combined with hormonal treatments, talking about lifestyle adaptations that are going to help, using naturopathic remedies where possible. And there's lots of information. Paula's support group is, one of the places where that can be. And directing patients to support organizations is a great way of supporting them and them getting extra information. Use of urinary antiseptics such as methanamine, fantastic resource. And where needed, please do refer on to fantastic surgeons like Dr. Coker, who can address any anatomical issues as need be.
I appreciate
to you, Dr.
that.
Coker.
So let's spend 1 minute talking. This is extremely important regarding the social complexities of health. There are many disparities, and this is a multi-layered, like an onion, issue that one has to recognize when a patient walks into the clinic. So depending on, again, several different backgrounds, medical health literacy, transportation limitations. You can have patients who have recurrent UTIs who simply can't access care. And so one just needs to be aware that these things and that these effects are impacting our patients' health. There are many different drivers of health, access, again, to social economic opportunities, resources close to home in the community, various conditions where one works, lives, breathes, plays, worships. So be sensitive to every patient's story is extremely important in providing the right care. If you look at data regarding, you know, those social determinants associated with recurrent UTIs, patients who are elderly tend to be at increased risk. There are certain, for example, income-related, interestingly, higher incomes may be associated with recurrent uncomplicated UTIs. Medicaid or let's say a governmental insurance can be a risk factor, and more comorbid patients tend to be at higher risk. So being sensitive to that and listening to the patient is key. And I think, as you mentioned earlier, multidisciplinary approach, collaborating with your colleagues is important, whether it's the patient to the caregiver, to the gyn, to the nurse, the urologist, which ironically looks like me, and the primary care. This is a webbed issue, and we all need to be in communication so that we're doing the best for our patients. I'd like to at least mention that in terms of main takeaways from this talk, there are specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, timely. And so when you are essentially looking at a patient, you need to not rely on the dipstick test alone when diagnosing a UTI, use the right antibiotic at the right dose. Goal three should be listening to the patient. I think all of us can agree listening is key. And goal four should be, you know, utilizing non-antibiotic alternatives whenever possible. So if you're going to, you know, throw antibiotics, you need to make sure you're treating the right thing and dealing with the right organism, use culture-specific data, and when you can for prophylaxis, use estrogen cream when they're postmenopausal. Talk about perhaps a postcoital prophylaxis. We didn't go into too much detail, but these are all very, very cogent points when dealing with patients with recurrent UTIs. Dr. Anderson, would you like to summarize?
Right. So yeah, in summary, we've already spoken about UTI. We've got acute UTI. We've got recurrent UTI. It even morphs into chronic UTI, even though we have diagnostic snow codes for chronic UTI, but we don't even have a medical definition. But watch this space. We are working on that. It is complex. It is evolving. There are treatment options available. There is a paucity of evidence-based medicine. It is not a sexy area of medicine that gets lots of investment, but it can be said that we as healthcare professionals can make a difference if we give it more recognition, more understanding, we utilize better diagnostics, we utilize treatment options and support further research studies to, you know, to aid diagnosis and treatment. And finally, do not forget to really advise your patients to access support organizations. This is a very lonely disease to be suffering in the wee small hours of the night when you're getting up to the toilet every hour. You know, to have somebody there on, you know, an online support group, you know, who can give you sympathy and hold you back from taking, you know, decisions like Paula mentioned previously. You know, she's had, you know, patients who have been suicidal with these, you know, life-altering diseases. So really, you know, consider everything and consider the full smorgasbord of treatments that are currently available. And now we have this very useful additional antibiotic that that Dr. Coker talked to us previously about. So, you know, think about everything and go treat UTIs with a completely different view from now on.
Excellent. So that was a great talk. I want to thank Dr. Anderson, Ms. Paula Cobb for all of the excellent commentary and education regarding this issue. We just have maybe perhaps, let's say, less than 5 minutes. I want to pick a few, cherry pick a few questions. Doctor, from the chat, Dr. Anderson, when do you refer to, say, a specialist? I mean, you are, again, a leading expert in your country, arguably internationally. Like, when would you pull in, say, a urologist or someone else outside of your field?
I think that depends on how comfortable the primary care physician, the family doctor is at actually intervening here. I think it's very important to rule out, anatomical problems. So if the primary care physician is happy to be ordering the early investigations such as an ultrasound, KUB, kidneys, ureter, bladder, to check that there's nothing obvious going on there, and you know, no marked residual volume post-micturition, post-urination, and if they are happy to kick in and treat one of these patients who is a revolving door patient with a longer course of antibiotics, maybe starting with a two-week course and seeing how they respond. And if they're responding well, maybe extend that course or maybe drop it to a prophylactic. And the prophylactic could be an antibiotic, could be the methanamine hippurate. If they're feeling confident in that area, they can do an awful lot here. And we've certainly given that freedom here in the UK. I'm not sure whether you are in the USA, but primary care physicians can change people's lives by just listening to them and recognizing that they are fitting into this cohort and there is something that we can do. And like we said, the vast majority of these patients are women. The vast majority of these patients will actually respond well to prophylaxis.
Very good. I just want to say thank you again to everyone who listened in. Ultimately, you can find these slides from the activity in the course guide under the resources tab of the program. That's all we have. I'd like to thank my colleagues, Dr. Anderson, Ms. Paula Cobb, for just a great discussion. Thank you, our audience, for tuning in, for joining us. Please visit the CME Outfitters virtual education hub for more useful resources on uncomplicated or complicated UTIs. Thank you again for my colleagues for joining me and for everyone listening in. Be safe, take care, and thanks for everything that everybody does for our patients. Take care.
Thank you.